This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Social distancing has had a lot of unintended side effects. One big one, most crime is down, way down. Major cities across the U.S. have seen a double-digit drop in crime, including drug arrests, home burglaries, and aggravated assaults. But the silver lining doesn't last long. While overall crime is down, homicides and shootings have gone up. One of the hardest-hit cities is Chicago, which reported a 51% increase in homicides this year compared to last. So why has some crime gone down, but other crime gone up? To talk us through it, we have Richard Rosenfeld, criminologist at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Welcome to 1A, Richard.
Good to be with you.
Also with us is David Abrams, professor at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School and the Wharton School. David, glad to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, David, I want to start with you because you created a website tracking crime during the pandemic in major cities across the U.S. Talk us through the types of crimes we saw decrease.
Sure. So citycrimestats.com, and it's something that listeners can go to themselves to see more, collects data from a number of large cities in the country to try to help us understand what is going on in the pandemic and also beyond through this unusual summer. We saw at the onset of the pandemic rapid and substantial declines in crime almost across the board. Drugs crimes fell by over 60% in the cities where that data is available. Property crimes fell by about 20%, and same with violent crimes. And so category-wise, it was pretty widespread, with the exception, as you mentioned, of homicide and shootings, which were pretty much flat during the onset of the pandemic. There are a couple other exceptions. Non-residential burglaries went up as people weren't in their offices. Those were better targets. And car thefts went up in a number of cities as well. We saw the decline being also very widespread across cities. So almost every city we looked at saw a substantial drop in crime. And this includes New York, Chicago, LA, Philadelphia, pretty much all the big cities in the country. The couple exceptions that didn't see much of a decline at the onset of the pandemic were Cincinnati and Seattle.
Well, Richard, the U.S. is experiencing something pretty unique right now with so much of the population spending more time at home due to the pandemic. What can this moment teach us about crime and human behavior?
Well, it teaches us that crime of the sort that David has been discussing and we're discussing thrives on activity patterns. And as street activity ebbs, as it has during the pandemic, opportunities to commit crime are reduced. For example, when people are quarantined, they're staying at home, residential burglaries go down because burglars tend to avoid occupied households. When the shops are closed, there's no shoplifting, and so larceny rates come down. So what it teaches us is that activity levels, activity patterns feed crime of the sort that we've been discussing.
David, before we let you go, a lot of crime typically happens between people who know each other. Experts warned we may see a rise in domestic violence when stay-at-home orders began to be issued. And Deidre wants to know whether or not the numbers reflect that.
Great question, one that a lot of people are interested in, including me. But that's one area I can tell you that the data that I've received is not particularly strong. We only had domestic violence data from a handful of cities, so not the 20 plus cities that we have most of the information for. So I would actually defer to another paper that I read by some economists who look specifically at domestic violence, and they looked at calls for service, so a slightly different measure of it in a number of different cities. They looked at some smaller cities than I focused on, and they found overall, and this was during the onset of the pandemic, so again, the March-April time span, they found an overall increase in domestic violence, although modest. And from their paper and from our understanding of domestic violence, we have to understand that a lot of it gets reported. It can be reported through schools and through other types of organizations that weren't functioning during this time period. So the process by which domestic violence reports or numbers for it was changing over this time period. So even though they saw a modest increase, it's likely that the true change would have been larger than that. And I think it's gonna take additional data and looking into it as we go back to that time period to try to understand more completely what the impact was.
We've got one more question from a listener who asks, it's not uncommon for police to lie about crime or the details of an incident. Could David say more about how he got his data and respond to concerns about whether we can trust it?
Sure. So almost everything that I've talked about today is crime reports. And we know from at least a few cities that the vast majority of those crime reports come from citizens, not from police. That's true for almost every category of crime except for drug crimes. For drug crimes, police reports constitute the majority, at least for the cities where we know that. So even if you're concerned that police reports aren't entirely accurate, it's unlikely that that would materially impact the numbers. I will say there's also not strong evidence that that there's widespread misreporting of crime incidents by police. So I wouldn't be too worried about that as impacting the numbers we've been discussing.
That's David Abrams, professor at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School and the Wharton School. David, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we have to take a quick break, but in a moment, we'll talk more about who is being impacted the most by a rise in crime. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from our guests and from you right after this.
Support for 1A and the following message come from Indeed. Indeed is here to help when small businesses have to be more efficient than ever, and every hire is critical. Indeed.com is the number one job site in the world because they get you the best people fast. You only pay for what you need, can pause your account at any time, and there are no long-term contracts. Try Indeed out with a free $75 credit at Indeed.com/1A. Terms and conditions apply. Offer valid through September 30th.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
Did you know that NPR has a Spanish language podcast? It's called Radio Ambulante. We tell the stories and make Latin America come to life. Amazing, unexpected stories, like lost gold in the Caribbean or playtime under quarantine or a life rediscovered after a bout of amnesia. Our new season has it all. New episodes every Tuesday starting September 15th. Listen now to the Radio Ambulante podcast from NPR.
I'm Jen White. 2020 has changed how we live and how we interact with the world, and that's reflected in this year's crime rates. Even as most crime drops, major cities are seeing a rise in homicides and shootings. So we've got an idea of the data, but who is this impacting most? Still with us, Richard Rosenfeld, criminologist at University of Missouri, St. Louis. And let's bring another voice into the conversation. Ojemar Mitchell is a professor at Arizona State University's School of Criminology and Criminal Justice. Ojemar, thanks for being here with us.
I'm happy to be here.
So we've been talking about an uptick in crime, like homicides and shootings, but this is affecting communities of color the most. How does race play into all of this?
Well, one of the things that struck me when Dr. Abrams was talking was the cities in which crime has gone up. It's like a who's who of the most racially segregated cities in America. You have Chicago, Boston, Nashville, Louisville. All these cities are highly racially segregated. And I believe that's one of the key components to explaining the racial disproportionality and the violence that we're seeing.
And build on that a little bit more about how segregation may be feeding this.
Sure. So segregation is due to deliberate, intentional acts of whites over the course of American history, created neighborhoods and that are exclusively African American. And in those communities, police have policed those communities more aggressively, yet at the same time neglected black victims. And that's led to a cultural adaptation where violence is used in a retaliatory fashion to extract justice when the justice system will not do it. So the police and the criminal justice system as a whole has lost legitimacy. And as a result, you see this cycle of violence.
We got this email from Sam who says the pandemic has decreased jobs. People get more desperate and crime goes up. Does a trend like this make sense, Richard?
Well, certainly it makes sense intuitively. It turns out, though, that the relationship between unemployment and crime is far more complex than I think most of us ordinarily would understand. During the Great Depression of the 1930s, for example, obviously that was a period of mass unemployment, but crime rates actually came down. During the Great Recession in 2008-2009, unemployment shot up, and again, crime rates came down. So, unemployment certainly induces the kind of stress that can contribute to crime. But if unemployment means that more people are staying home, they're off the streets in their homes, they're in effect protecting their homes against residential burglary, and if they're not on the street, opportunities for crime on the street go down as well. So unemployment certainly does, I think, contribute to the motivation to commit crime, but at the same time, it reduces opportunities for crime, and both are important.
When you think about the dynamics that are playing out right now, Otemar, what do you think needs to happen in order to reduce the number of homicides and shootings that we've been seeing over the summer?
That's a really important issue and a big problem. I think one of the things that would help is talking with these rival groups. We know exactly who they are. You go to any police department in the United States that has one of these problems, they know the players. And they need to communicate with the players that their violence needs to stop and provide opportunities for them to engage in more pro-social activities, and let them know that if they continue their violence, the full force of the law will come down upon them.
Richard, your thoughts?
Yeah, I quite agree. What the research shows is that one of the most effective ways of reducing violence is through the approach in our business, we call it focused deterrence. And what it means is to focus on those individuals and groups in the community that have the highest risk for perpetrating the next act of violence or becoming the next victim, calling them into meetings and providing that two-pronged message. We obviously know who you are. We'll pull all available levers to take you off the street if you persist. And we want to protect you. And here are services and supports that are available if you want to take another path.
We've been talking to Otemar Mitchell, professor at Arizona State University's School of Criminology and Criminal Justice. Otemar, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Richard Rosenfeld is going to stick around. We're talking about crime and coronavirus, and in a moment, how the politicization of crime may impact our elections. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
Comedian Larry Wilmore has had quite the career, but maybe his most infamous moment came from a single joke he made to President Obama back in 2016.
There was a rallying cry from people who said, "Yes, Larry Wilmore, thank you. That was the blackest thing I've ever seen in my life," you know.
Listen to the It's Been a Minute podcast from NPR.
We're talking about crime rates during the rise of COVID-19 and why overall crime is down, but homicides and killings are going up. One person who's been quick to pick up on this trend is President Trump, who pivoted to some law and order messaging this summer. We asked you how high crime ranks in your decision at the ballot box, and here's what you had to say.
Hello, my name is Isaac. I'm in Minneapolis, just blocks from the George Floyd Memorial Square.
My name's Julia. I'm calling from Atlanta, Georgia. We know that historically being tough on crime and law and order do not improve crime rates. What improves crime is helping people.
I'd like to see politicians get to the root cause of crime, which would be poverty, drug addiction, homelessness.
That means access to health care. That means education. That means control on skyrocketing housing prices. That means rent relief. That means closing the pay gap.
As far as law and order candidates are concerned, I'm just reminded of people like Clinton, who moved to the middle and then gave us three strikes, you're out policies, which we now are not benefiting from, or Nixon was our law and order candidate, and look at where that got us.
Cracking down on people who are suffering and struggling is not something that I'm interested in choosing a candidate for.
Here to talk through what crime means for the political battlefield this November is Michael Flam, professor of history at Ohio Wesleyan University. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And still with us is Richard Rosenfeld, criminologist at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. And before we move on, I just want to mention we got several comments about domestic violence during this conversation. A note that we devoted a whole episode to domestic violence earlier in the pandemic. It's called Coronavirus, When Staying Home Isn't Safe. And you can find that show on your podcast feed. Michael, President Trump isn't the first so-called law and order president. Can you give us some context to how this phrase has been used within politics?
Well, law and order first emerged as an issue in, you know, national politics, presidential politics in 1964, when Senator Barry Goldwater from Arizona tried to use it during his campaign against President Lyndon Johnson. And it didn't work in 1964. Primarily, I would argue, because the fear factor simply wasn't high enough yet in the United States. 4 years later, as we know, as one of your listeners commented, Richard Nixon was able to run successfully on a platform of law and order. And it was that issue more than the Vietnam War that eventually put him in the White House.
What does law and order actually mean to people when it's used in politics?
Well, that's a terrific question. In fact, what makes law and order such a powerful and potent political slogan is its amorphous quality, its vague quality. I like to describe law and order, it's the Rorschach test of American politics. Mm-hmm. Anxious voters can project onto that phrase, law and order, whatever concern or anxiety or fear is foremost in their minds at the time.
So you said law and order first emerged in 1964 as a political platform, but how has crime been politicized even earlier in American politics?
Well, crime has always been an issue in American politics, but primarily at the state or above all at the local level. I mean, constitutionally speaking, crime control is not a matter for the federal government. I mean, it's important to realize that the New York Police Department alone employs more officers than sort of the entire law enforcement apparatus of the federal government, depending on how you define it. Throughout history, crime has been a really important issue for mayors and sometimes for governors, but rarely has it seeped into presidential politics. There's some exceptions. Herbert Hoover was talking about it in 1928 during the Prohibition era. You know, so there are some moments where it bubbles to the surface, but it really isn't until the 60s when it becomes a sort of a relatively constant feature of presidential politics. And then we see it in the 80s with Reagan, you know, and then we see it in the 90s, as one of your listeners also commented, with Clinton. And, you know, now we see it again in 2020.
Richard, how is this law and order message playing out for President Trump? Is it an effective political tool this year?
Well, I don't think it's playing out certainly in the way that he would like or has intended. The problem is that when the incumbent is promoting a law and order message and in the accompanying fear, and then tries to blame someone who's not in office, Vice President Biden, that's a tough one. It's tough to square that circle. So it's President Trump who's been in charge. Under his watch, we've seen increases in violence in many cities. And it's very, very difficult to then claim, well, somehow that's Joe Biden's responsibility or fault. Or claims such as, well, it's the fault of so-called Democrat mayors. Mayors actually don't have much wherewithal with respect to controlling the conditions that give rise to crime, including the recent uptick in crime. The fact that a city's mayor is a Democrat or Republican means virtually nothing with respect to crime control. So I think it's a tough message for the president to sell.
Michael, we heard from some of our listeners earlier that they're more interested in politicians addressing the underlying issues that lead to crime. Historically, why do we see politicians target crime as opposed to some of those root causes?
Well, here it's important, I think, to note that since the 1960s, liberals have stressed the need to attack the root causes of crime and violence in America, and conservatives have taken a different approach. So judging by the comments from your listeners, I would say they probably fall on the sort of liberal end of the political spectrum. You know, that's something we heard in the 1960s, and certainly Lyndon Johnson, you know, made his war on poverty very much a part of his war on crime. The problem for liberals and for Johnson is that by 1968, you've had a war on poverty, But the crime rates are even higher than they were earlier. Crime rates, particularly violent crime, skyrockets in the 1960s. Now, liberals like President Johnson will argue that the war on poverty prevented the problem from getting even worse. But that's kind of a hard argument to make in politics. And I think it's above all, it's really important to remember that the politicization of crime is not ultimately about policy, at least not from the conservative perspective. It's really about fomenting fear. You know, it's making the electorate anxious and then giving them targets or scapegoats to blame for the loss of security.
But we have seen tough on crime messaging from people on both sides of the aisle over time.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And in fact, one of the legacies or consequences of the 60s is that liberals, like Bill Clinton eventually, going back to him in the 1990s, conclude that the only way to diffuse this issue is to become tougher on crime, more like the conservatives, blur the differences between liberals and conservatives in order to be more politically viable.
You know, there's data and then there are anecdotes. How often do feelings and anecdotes rather than data end up shaping policy around crime?
Oh, there's a tremendous amount of evidence, social science evidence, that you know, anecdotes, emotions, that's what really drives people's feelings, not hard data or evidence. This is often a sort of a red button emotional issue, and that's what candidates seek to push when they're running for office. I do want to agree, by the way, that I do think that in 2020, the issue of law and order is not cutting as well for President Trump as he would like. He's finding it much more difficult to blame Vice President Biden. And in fact, I think many polls are showing that that a majority of Americans, at least at this point, see Biden as more likely to restore law and order than President Trump, who has an incendiary reputation with many Americans at this point.
Well, Michael, a lot of your research focuses on moments of protests and policing in history. How does our current political moment compare to what you've studied?
You know, it's quite comparable in some ways, and it's different in others. All historical analogies are like that. What I do think is really interesting to note is you have this intersection of uprisings, rebellions, protests against police with presidential politics. And, you know, we witnessed that in 1968. We witnessed that in 1964. The first major riot of the 1960s takes place in Harlem and then Bed-Stuy in New York City. And President Johnson has to work very, very hard to sort of dampen anxiety around those developments because his opponent, Senator Goldwater, has raised the law and order issue, and Johnson is very fearful of it. So, you know, in that case, Johnson is the incumbent, a little different in 68. The best historical example, I think, right now might be 1992, President Bush and the L.A. riot and what happened then.
Richard, the president has blamed protests in particular for contributing to crime. Recently, Attorney General William Barr suggested bringing sedition charges against protesters, which charges them with plotting to overthrow the government. What do we know about a connection, if any at all, between protests and crime rates?
There is a connection. It's not a simple one. It's relatively complex. We can go back 5 years ago after the events in Ferguson, Chicago, New York, Baltimore, and elsewhere. That was also a period of widespread social unrest around the problem of police violence. And we saw homicide rates increase during that period. During the current period, after George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis, in particular, we've seen an uptick in homicide corresponding with widespread protests against police violence. So we tend to see the crime rates increase during periods of social unrest. The question is why. I would say this, however. We need to take President Trump's remarks seriously for the following reason. Not because they're an accurate depiction of reality, but because they encourage some people in the population in the view that the police are standing down, the cities are out of control, and self-appointed armed militias then increasingly show up in the midst of the protest, and that can have disastrous consequences, such as we saw in Portland and Kenosha, Wisconsin. So while I don't think the president is correct, factually, those statements he makes can provide encouragement for a kind of vigilantism that we certainly do not want in our cities.
We got this email from John in Virginia Beach who says, it's amazing that no one mentions law and order in the same breath as white-collar crime and rampant corruption, which is more damaging to the nation than the targeted crimes, especially in low-income communities. Michael, talk about what John is saying there. Unpack that for us a bit.
You know, first of all, he's right. He's absolutely right. But historically, white-collar crime has never received the same amount of attention as violent crime. I mean, the costs of white-collar crime are often dispersed much more widely, and they don't necessarily affect people as directly or viscerally as violent crime. It doesn't make the same kind of headlines in newspapers or, you know, on television or things like that. So he's right. You know, if in a perfectly rational world, we should focus much more attention on white-collar crime than we do. But we don't live in that world.
As we're wrapping up here, Richard, we've got about 30 seconds. Any last thoughts you want to leave us with?
We can and will get through this period of rising violence. Your listeners, however, point to the underlying conditions that generate chronically high levels of violence. And as we come down off this slope of a rise in violence, we have to keep our eye on those underlying conditions so that the next time we see a rise, it's from a much lower base than is the case currently.
That's Richard Rosenfeld, criminologist at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, and Michael Flam, professor of history at Ohio Wesleyan University. Thanks to you both. Today's producer was Michelle Harvin. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.